Hey guys, it's Asher from The Takeaway, and on today's show, we're going to discuss doctors who are on the front lines of gun violence and how they've suddenly become advocates for their patients from a policy perspective. Then we're going to move into the story in Syria, where a tenuous ceasefire has allowed civilians in the besieged region of eastern Ghouta to escape to the north. And then we're going to talk about the disparity that women of color face in the healthcare industry in the United States. That's all on today's show on The Takeaway, March 27th, 2018.
This is The Takeaway, and I'm Duarte Geraldino, filling in for Todd Zwillick while he's on vacation. I'm glad you're here with me.
I was shot twice. I was grazed on my back and ricocheted on my chest. My best friend was killed right in front of me.
It doesn't make sense. Fix it. Should have been one school shooting and we should have fixed it.
I thought I was going to die.
I'm still just shaking a bit because, that's my baby sister, you know?
We located numerous firearms within the room that he occupied.
I think the most realistic hope is that we cannot continue to do the same things and expect different outcomes.
We're going to walk out of school. We're going to register people to vote. We're going to add people to an email list, and we're going to get people involved in this issue.
As we cover gun violence in the news, the people on the front lines can slip into the background. Trauma surgeons and nurses are the ones who see the victims come in, bleeding and torn and full of holes. These doctors try to save them. Now, gun violence is expensive. Hospitals and emergency rooms rack up nearly $3 billion a year in financial costs related to gunshot wounds. But there are also other costs that are much more difficult to quantify, like the mental and emotional toll on victims, families, and the medical professionals who treat gunshot victims. Because there have been no major changes in legislation or policies, frustration among doctors is growing almost as fast as the number of victims. That's why some physicians are turning to advocacy when they're not in the ER. They say there's no time left to waste. Dr. Rob Gore is an attending physician and clinical assistant professor at Kings County Hospital. He's also the executive director of the Kings Against Violence Initiative. And Dr. Amy Goldberg is Surgeon-in-Chief at Temple University's Health System in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. Welcome, doctors.
Thanks for having
Thank
us.
You.
So, Dr. Goldberg, first, take us through the experience of working with your patients when you see them with gunshot wounds.
Well, we've all had a lot of training, so even though when we see these patients, we could be very distracted by the types of wounds or the number of wounds, we're very focused on what we need to do at that moment to save that patient's life.
And Dr. Gore, how many gunshot victims do you treat every year?
At our hospital alone, we might have close to 200, and some years maybe a little bit more, some a little bit less. That's just gunshot wounds. That's not including stab wounds or blunt trauma that's of a violent nature.
Now, on an emotional level, how has treating these injuries changed you?
I grew up in Brooklyn, in pre-gentrified Brooklyn, and, we were around during the crack cocaine era, so I used to see a lot of violence taking place back then, and even just getting to and from school. So it's not something that you're foreign to, but when you are the physician in charge and it's your role to not just take care of the physical needs, but also address some of the mental health needs, and then when it comes from your neighborhood and these may be individuals that you have a personal connection to, not just like, just as a black physician, living in a black neighborhood and working in a black neighborhood, but actually treating people that you know, it takes on a completely different context. It becomes completely personalized.
Dr. Goldberg, I want to turn to you. You have said that Sandy Hook could have been a teachable moment. What did you mean by that?
I think, really what we need to do as trauma surgeons, emergency medicine physicians, is really to educate our citizens and our politicians on what bullets can do to bodies. And after these mass shootings occur, we always see the pictures of the victims, and we don't see the pictures of what the patients looked like injured. By no means would I ever want to be disrespectful to anybody, not the patients or their families, but, after 25 years as a trauma surgeon in North Philadelphia, I'm desperate. I'm desperate to think of the teachable moment that, as a country, might change some of our gun laws. And I really felt that if in that moment when, you know, young kids were shot in Sandy Hook, if that really couldn't change how we addressed gun violence, then I really didn't know what would. And I had really thought about, you know, suggesting that even autopsy pictures be shown.
Again,
not
gruesome.
In any, yeah, I mean, not in any disrespectful way. And I'm sure Dr. Gore can attest to how gruesome it really is, and that stark contrast to what we may see in the trauma bays and then what gets covered on our TVs and in our newspapers.
The both of you have chosen to do more than just treat your patients in the hospital. You're taking that next step. You both have organizations that help, in theory, to reduce the number of patients you see. Can you talk to me about your organization?
Yeah, we have two programs at Temple University Hospital. We have a Cradle to Grave program, which is really a prevention program where we educate students in middle school and high school as to the realities of gun violence. We'd like to see ourselves as, you know, the professors of gun violence. So we bring these kids in and we take them through the path of a very unfortunate 16-year-old boy who was shot multiple times and died in our trauma bay. And that's our Cradle to Grave, our prevention program. The other program that we have is called Turning Point. That's a intervention program where after the patients have recovered from their injuries but are still hospitalized, we like to, again, continue the education of, you know, what went on to help save their lives. So if patients elect, we allow them to see the trauma bay video of all the people that worked on them after they were injured and all of the energy and commitment that went into save their lives. And then we work very hard with a multitude of different organizations within the city to, when they leave the hospital, to help them get to their doctor's appointments, help them to get a high school diploma, or help them get a job, or more importantly, deal with the emotional stresses of having been shot, where we can hook them up with psychiatrists and group therapy so that they can, you know, try to repair the emotional wounds that they suffered after they were shot.
And in that way, you are really sort of affecting the community as well. Dr. Gore, you heard Dr. Goldberg and her program. Now, you also have a program, Kings Against Violence Initiative. Talk to us about that.
Right. So Kings Against Violence Initiative, also known as CAVI, is a multi-tiered violence intervention and prevention program. First, we view that everyone is entitled to be safe and have a safe space. And when violence and conflict affect different aspects of your life, you feel very vulnerable. And so that's the complete opposite of feeling having a safe space. And so for our hospital-based intervention, we work with young people who've been shot and stabbed and beat or attacked with blunt objects to help provide resources and become advocates for those individuals. When you've been injured, you're terrified. This is a completely traumatic experience, and we want to make sure that we have people who can spend time with those individuals, but also help provide resources and wraparound services, case management, really to make sure that those victims and survivors don't come back. As there's a rate of recurrence about 40 to 45% after somebody's been injured initially.
So say that again.
So if somebody's been shot, their rate of re-injury is as high as 40-44% within 5 years after that initial injury.
That they're going to be shot again.
Yes. And the rate of the homicide rate is as high as 20% within that initial 5 years after that first injury.
It's sort of, I'm sort of left speechless for a moment of thinking about this. So you see a patient and you are trying to save his or her life knowing that
they may come back.
The both of you are doing so much outside of hospitals. Right now, our entire country, we're focused on these protests for gun control. No matter what side of the aisle you're on, what lessons can we learn? What should we be focusing on, given your unique experiences? Dr. Goldberg, why don't you go first?
I think number one is it certainly is a public health crisis, and it needs to be seen that way and needs to be attacked that way. Number two, we mustn't lose the sense of urgency that people are feeling right now. and whether that's getting folks to go out and vote so that we can change the politicians who will be voting on these gun laws, then we need to do that. And then three, you know, the education piece of it. Again, I am convinced that, you know, America doesn't really know what really occurs to our patients, whether it's the physical wounds or the emotional wounds. I don't really think that they understand it.
You don't think they understand it? What about you, Dr. Gore?
In addition to some stuff that Dr. Goldberg mentioned, one, we have to pay attention to mental health needs of patients and families who are affected by violence and trauma. You've got more than 20% of people who've been injured violently who will still suffer from symptoms consistent with post-traumatic stress even a year after that initial incident. And you think about what happens when somebody experiences PTSD, anxiety, depression, and if there's pre-existing mental illness already, it just exacerbates it because you've just lowered the threshold for when somebody's going to have a crisis related to that mental health problem. So understanding the need for PTSD screening is important. Then number two is making sure that those individuals who've been identified will have also have access to treatment, care, and therapy, which is going to be important and essential for long-term survivability. The other thing is, you know, there's the family dynamic, which is exceptionally important that we have to pay attention to. And if not just treating the patients, but treating those individuals and addressing the individuals who are going to be in close proximity to that patient. Which violence is definitely a public health issue, but we also have to look at it in some spaces as, you know, how people adapt to trauma is it's a lifestyle in some respects. And so lifestyle adjustments, as we've seen in every other health issue, whether it's diabetes, hypertension, smoking, it's very difficult to change because there's so many different elements that contribute to that problem.
Thank you so much, doctors. Dr. Rob Gore, attending physician and clinical assistant professor at Kings County Hospital and SUNY Downstate Medical Center. He's also the executive director of the Kings Against Violence Initiative. And Dr. Amy Goldberg, surgeon-in-chief, Temple University Health System in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. Thank you, doctors.
Thank you.
Thank you.
This is Nur from East Ghouta. Here, there is no water, no food, no life.
That's Nur. She's 10 years old and lives in Eastern Ghouta in Syria. In the video posted on Twitter last week, she describes what life is like for her. Her neighborhood in Eastern Ghouta has been under siege by the Syrian government forces for the past month. More than 1,600 civilians are now dead. Thousands of others are wounded. But late last week, it all stopped. A ceasefire was reached. Thousands of civilians and rebel fighters were allowed to leave Ghouta to go to the province of Idlib in the northwest. Here are two civilians on their way speaking to Al Jazeera on Monday.
They burned everything, even the bunkers we were hiding in. If we left the bunkers, we would get killed by airstrikes. I can't describe the situation we were in. It was awful.
We left our homes behind, although everything has been destroyed. We left our history, our memories. We left all that behind because we couldn't tolerate the circumstances.
For more on the latest in Eastern Ghouta, we go to Karim Shaheen. He's Middle Eastern reporter for The Guardian. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
So remind us where Eastern Ghouta is and what has been happening over there.
Right. So Eastern Ghouta is a suburb of the Syrian capital, Damascus. It's this vast agricultural area that used to be the breadbasket of the capital. In 2012, it fell to forces that were opposed to Syrian President Bashar al-Assad and were trying to overthrow him. And over the last month and a half or so, it has been under a very tight siege, continuous, relentless bombardment by the Syrian government and by its Russian allies in an effort to take it, because it's an extremely strategically important area, given its proximity to the capital.
We heard that video where that young girl talks about how difficult life is. Can you give us a sense of the destruction? We know that there's been bombings. What's it like now, that sense of destruction?
Yeah, I mean, some of the doctors that we've been speaking to on a regular basis inside Ghouta have been talking about, you know, unprecedented levels of destruction. The phrase, they've burned the whole place down, is one that you hear quite frequently. In the space of a little bit over a month, we have 1,500 people who've been killed. We have thousands more wounded as a result of the airstrikes, the shelling, various types of weaponry, incendiary weapons. And people have spent much of the last month actually living in bomb shelters in their basements, families packed like sardines in these shelters. There was obviously enormous amounts of hunger because the siege has been so tight for so many months. And prior to the last wave of attacks, there had been several cases of malnutrition among children in the area. Children who had died because their mothers were no longer able to breastfeed them because their mothers themselves were under malnutrition. And so it's been a devastating situation all around for much of the last few months, and particularly intense under the airstrikes over the last month.
So why now was there a ceasefire agreed to? What was the trigger for this?
The attacks have been so intense that there was also some pressure on the rebels to negotiate some sort of settlement. The regime advances backed by Russian airstrikes have been quite rapid. Essentially, their strategy was to isolate the various towns of Eastern Ghouta into three pockets that are disconnected from the other parts of the region. And so they succeeded in doing that quite quickly after they began the offensive. And so you had these three patches of ground under an even more tightened siege and under quite an intense bombardment, both from the air and from artillery. And so eventually the rebels there realized that it wasn't sustainable. There were demands from the civilians that they need to get out. And as the regime was advancing, there are occasions when, you see thousands of civilians simply fleeing those areas, that had been under intense bombardment for, the last few hours, and fleeing towards the regime forces that had been bombarding them out of desperation. And so there has been mounting pressure for some sort of deal whereby, people who want to be evacuated can be evacuated or potentially stay and reconcile with the government under Russian guarantees.
There is one rebel holdout in Eastern Ghouta in Syria. It's the city of Douma. That's where one resident posted a video over the weekend of what looked like bright snowfall in the night. It looks incredibly beautiful, but it's actually a sign of destruction. That effect was caused by phosphorus bombs being launched by the Assad government.
The bombing of Bashar Assad forces Douma city, Eastern Ghouta. My God.
So, Karim, focusing on Douma, how many people live there? What's the situation like for them?
Yeah, it's really difficult to get accurate numbers because several thousand people have left the area through a humanitarian crossing that had been set up near Douma. The estimates from locals, which might be a bit exaggerated, is between 200 and 250,000, possibly as low as 150,000. But it is the most populated city in Eastern Ghouta, and used to be, before the war, was one of the top 10 largest cities in all of Syria. In terms of the conditions of civilians in there, it's very much similar to the rest of the region. It had been under bombardment, but the difference with Douma is that occasionally there have been humanitarian convoys that have been allowed in to the city, led by the UN and the Red Cross. And the Syrian Arab Red Crescent, although the warehouses where they've stored some of the goods have been bombed in the course of the campaign as well.
So what's the symbolic importance of Douma in this war?
Douma is an extremely important area because it was one of the largest cities to fall out of government control very early on in the conflict. It's a center of activism. Many people there are opposed to President Bashar al-Assad and his government, and have been for a very long time. Obviously, Douma also was one of the areas that suffered from the chemical attacks in 2013. And, it's simply been an opposition stronghold for much of the conflict. And it's also extremely heavily populated. And the question now is, all those people who are still there and those people who took part actively in the opposition campaign against Bashar al-Assad and in the war against him and the civil uprising against him as well, what their fates are going to be now that negotiations are ongoing and the city is completely surrounded.
So is there any chance, Karim, that rebels can actually hold on to the city, or is it just a matter of time before Assad and Russia have full control?
I think it's a matter of time. I mean, right now there are a lot of negotiations that are going on between the main rebel group there, which is called Jaish al-Islam, and the Russian government representatives. So the question that they're dealing with is really a question of forced displacement. The other areas of Ghouta reached an agreement with the Russians predicated on the idea that all the fighters are going to be exiled, that all the civilians who want to leave are going to be exiled. But you're talking about, you know, over 150,000 civilians in Douma, a lot of whom have taken part in the uprising actively and so, you know, would not trust Russian guarantees or regime guarantees that they will not be prosecuted or arrested or, you know, drafted into the army. And so it's going to be a monumental catastrophe if the fighting goes on, because 150,000 civilians who are faced with the choice of either dying in the fighting or being forcibly exiled somewhere else in Syria at such a large scale is something that's quite difficult to conceive of, even from a logistical point of view, let alone from a humanitarian point of view. And right now, there's a ceasefire while those negotiations go on. The rebel groups are adamantly opposed to the idea of being exiled out of the region. And so there's a possibility that the fighting that we've seen, which has been extremely brutal over the last month and a half, is going to resume again and is going to be a lot worse for civilians there, because they're essentially the only holdout at this point.
It's so chilling when you say it could be a lot worse. If you could tell us in a phrase as we're ending this interview, what's next in the Syrian war?
I think, you know, further humanitarian catastrophes unless a political solution is found, unless everyone is brought to the table and forced somehow to talk by all their international sponsors.
Thank you so much, Karim Shaheen, Middle East reporter for The Guardian.
Thank you for having me.
Sacramento is a city on edge. It's been that way ever since police shot and killed 22-year-old Stephon Clark last week. Clark was only holding a cell phone, but officers say they thought he had a gun. They shot at him 20 times. Police were responding to 911 calls about robberies in the neighborhood. Officers claim they believed Clark was a robbery suspect. Police shot him dead in his backyard. His funeral is scheduled for Thursday. Pastor Joey Johnson is president of Sacramento Area Congregations Together. She says the weekend's protests sent the message that if the city is going to move on, it needs to heal first.
It was tense, intense. It actually carries a sense of grief and mourning. There's a deeper grief, the grief around the regularity with which these kinds of incidences and issues keep occurring. And now the grief over it hitting our city. We certainly had hoped to avoid, be benefited from not having it hit our city, but it has indeed. And so that grief.
It hits at such an interesting time for your city. You have the first African-American police chief, you know, a man who's leading the force that is now being blamed for this young man's death. Are people blaming the police in general, or are they blaming him? And is it even possible to separate the two, because he is the man in charge?
He is the man in charge indeed, but I believe that we as a community are blaming the police force and looking at how is it that we have a trained, credible, credentialed force of men and women who still operate in so much fear toward our community, fear of our community. So it doesn't rest with one man who's at the helm, but it seems to rest more and more with how individuals are trained and how they come to each call or crisis in so much fear of people of color.
That video is so incredibly disturbing, almost as powerful are the videos of all the demonstrators. And in particular, we see his brother, Stevante.
20 times!
And you can hear there Stevante saying 20 times. And on this video, Stevante is speaking directly to police officers during a protest. And in a lot of ways, he articulates what a lot of people feel. But obviously, as the brother of the slain 22-year-old, he feels it most acutely.
Right.
Is there any way that people can move past that and recognize a solution to this?
What his brother expressed, and I applaud him for being able to express it, is exactly, maybe not to the degree or to the depth, but it is exactly what the community is feeling, that whatever the criminal action might have been to prompt this, why would it warrant 20 shots? And for that to settle with us as a community, someone will need to be held accountable, or this pain that we're feeling in the city is, it would be very difficult, let me say it this way, it would be very difficult to heal the pain that we're suffering in the city. We are going to have the public conversations to try to draw us together as different cultures and different ethnicities who simply don't understand each other and who simply don't trust one another. But in addition to that, there's got to be some accountability, some notable accountability on somebody's part.
We understand now that the Clark family has hired the same attorney that represented Michael Brown's family. We're talking about attorney Benjamin Crump. What's the feeling about that selection? Is he the man for this job?
Well, it was up to the family to choose whom they would. I would say he is the man for the job to draw the connection between this issue, this incident, and all of the others, because they are connected. And unless there's someone who can draw the connection, I think it's easy for the public to look at it and at each issue in an isolated way. But this is systemic, and it needs a systemic answer. Now, we do understand that law enforcement is one of the most difficult careers there is. It's one of the most challenging and intense careers there is. So the training needs to be something that prepares the individuals to arrive at those incidences and those cases with a clearer head and a calmer heart.
A clearer head and a calmer heart. Right now, there are a lot of people focused on Sacramento, a lot of celebrities, a lot of national and international attention, specifically in the sports world. We know that the Sacramento Kings responded with a public service announcement, and the Boston Celtics partnered with them on wearing T-shirts with Clark's name on it. Right now, a lot rests not just on justice, but also messaging, the communication. I want to play you some of the PSA that the Sacramento Kings released.
Black, white, brown.
We are one.
We are one.
One.
We will not stick to sports.
We will not shut up and dribble.
This is bigger than basketball.
Change can be uncomfortable.
Change is necessary. We need to talk.
We need to act.
We matter.
We must unite.
Say his name.
Stephon Clark.
Stephon Clark.
How do you receive that PSA? What do you think the message that we should take away from that is?
Well, as a pastor, I have a phrase that I'd like to use, and I apply that to this PSA, and that is that we are indeed our brother's brother. We are our sister's sister. And the best way for us to live out our lives is to imagine that I am the only sister you have, and that I would treat you to the best ability as a common human being, and we're sharing this space of life together. And there's an expectation there, and I think that PSA says it very clearly. There's an expectation that we must learn how to live a different way, loving one another as opposed to fearing one another, supporting one another as opposed to killing one another. And so that, I believe that indeed will reduce and mitigate all of the violence that's plaguing our land.
Thank you very much, Pastor Joy Johnson, president of the Sacramento Area Congregations Together, SAC Act. Thank you.
Thank you.
Stephon Clark has been added to a long list of black men killed by police, a list that also includes Alton Sterling. Sterling, you may remember, was shot and killed at very close range by a police officer in a parking lot in Baton Rouge, Louisiana. Another officer was holding him down at the time. Today, the Attorney General of Louisiana announced the two officers involved, who are both white, the one who shot Sterling and the other one who held him down, will not be charged. The AG says, under the circumstances, the officers' actions were justified. Well, it took some time, but on Monday, the Trump administration retaliated against Moscow for the poisoning of a former Russian spy in Britain. It did so in solidarity with the EU and other NATO allies. Now, the numbers keep growing, but so far, more than 20 countries have expelled some 140 Russians, including 60 Russian nationals who were ordered to leave the United States. It's the latest, and as of yet, most significant response from the West against Vladimir Putin's regime. But what do these actions really mean? And how will Russia respond to such a bold and coordinated punishment? Joining us now is Anna Borishevskaya. She's a Russia expert and Ira Weiner Fellow at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. So, Anna, the latest actions against Russia are the strongest response since the Cold War by the U.S. and its allies. Can you lay out the specifics of the response? How big of a coalition are we talking about here? Would you consider it historic?
Sure. And first, thank you for having me. It's great to be on the show. This is certainly a major response. As you said, it is the biggest response to Russia since the Cold War. And what this says is, for the first time, this is not mere symbolism. The sheer number of Russian nationals who are being expelled, especially from the United States, for example, what this means is that they will curb Russia's intelligence gathering activities in the United States and in the West. Certainly other countries, for example, Poland, who have expelled a smaller number of Russian citizens, that, you know, when you're talking about smaller numbers, this is more symbolism. But it also shows, in terms of symbolism, solidarity in the West. And that's very important, that for the first time, it's not just one or two countries. This is really more of a coalition. And that sends a very strong message that the West is finally understanding the true danger that Putin's Russia poses to the West, to its values of freedom and democracy, and that for the first time, it's really trying to stand up to him.
So you say the West is finally just now understanding the true danger that it faces. So all this is happening because that former Russian spy and his daughter were poisoned in the UK on March 4th. Russia still denies playing a role. Do we have any clear idea where this attack came from, if not from the Russians?
Well, that's exactly it. It's hard to see where else it could have come from. And frankly, the evidence is overwhelming. It's almost a near certainty that it did come from the Russians. And the fact of the matter is, look, this happened in the context of Russia's presidential so-called election in the run-up to the so-called election, when Putin was looking for many different ways to rally support. And he was doing this through enforcing the besieged fortress narrative in Russia, for example. And this was a statement to the West. You know, there's many ways to interpret what happened, but the way I read it is that this was a statement to the West, frankly, a fairly public one, because, you know, to state the obvious, there's many different ways to kill somebody. And this was pretty public and loud to say, look, you know, this is what we can do to you, and there's nothing you're going to do about it. We own you. That's the message.
So you're saying that this was such a public attack because Russia is trying to tell the U.S., we own you. Is that what you're saying?
Well, not to the U.S., but to the West, and in this case, to the U.K. I think, yeah, it's a public message of this is what we can do to you. And so I think the response from the West finally realizing that this won't do is very important.
Was the Kremlin, do you think, anticipating this strong of a response from the U.S. and its allies?
I'm not so sure. It's hard to tell because, again, you know, unfortunately, we don't have a strong record of standing up to Putin's Russia. And I think he probably did not expect such a strong response. And I will say down the road, this is a good start, but it's not enough. We have to look at the oligarchs. We have to look at curbing all the financial activities of Russia in the West, especially in the UK. For example, looking at such things as the Magnitsky Act that punishes some of Russia's worst human rights violators in the Putin circle. And it's really the finances, that's where it is. So we need to look at more of these activities and curbing Russia's illicit financial activities in the West.
Russia promised to punch back, but so far Moscow has not given any specifics. When Obama expelled 35 Russians toward the end of his term, the Russians eventually responded in kind, kicking out Americans and seizing two diplomatic compounds. Do you have any idea what the retaliatory action this time might look like?
It's hard to tell. You know, if we look back historically, what happened with the Magnitsky Act passed here is Putin responded in just the most despicable way by banning Americans from adopting Russian children. And it's possible that he may try to find another similar response, or it may be something else. We don't really know. But, you know, look, certainly he will look for ways to retaliate. But this doesn't mean that we shouldn't have done this, because for years, Putin perceived weakness from the West. And it's because he perceived weakness that he's been pushing and he's been trying, working to undermine the U.S. The only way to stand up to him is to show strength. And for too long, he has perceived weakness.
So he's perceived weakness. Right now, the only way to stand up to him is to show strength. But what about on the ground in Russia? How are the expulsions of all these Russians in the West likely to be felt, if at all, in Russia?
Well, if at all, the way the Kremlin is going to try to spin it is, of course, again, the besieged fortress narrative, the West is out to get us. But the fact of the matter is the Kremlin was doing that before as well, and it's going to continue doing that. For years, this message of America is the enemy has already been spun. So with or without the expulsions, that would have continued.
So with or without the expulsions, this would have continued. And at this point, is there anything about this case that you think we just don't understand?
Well, I think there's still many questions behind why this happened. There's different interpretations still about what the Kremlin was trying to achieve. I only have one interpretation, but maybe I'm not 100% right. There's a lot we still don't know. But the fact of the matter is, this was an aggressive act of Russia on foreign soil against UK nationals, and there had to be a response.
There had to be a response. Thank you so much, Anna Borshevskaya, Russian expert and Ira Weiner Fellow at the Washington Institute. Thank you.
Thank you.
It's The Takeaway, and I'm Duarte Geraldino. We move now to the latest in our series this week called Taking Pains with Women's Health. Today, we look at health disparities for women of color. Dr. Aletha Maybank spends a lot of time thinking about this. She is Deputy Commissioner and Founding Director of the Center for Health Equity at the New York City Health Department. She's here to talk about why the disparities persist and where we can make meaningful change. Welcome, Dr. Maybank.
Thank you. Thanks for having me today.
So first, give us the lay of the land, if you would. How big is the gap for women of color when it comes to getting health care and staying healthy in America?
Well, as a woman and as a Black woman, before I go into the statistics, I think it's very important that I honor the dignity of women. What I'm very clear of is that sometimes rattling off the numbers without acknowledgement of a personal or emotional burden can be hard for people to listen to the stats. And while epidemiology is crucial to understanding the health of people, we always know that we are more than the sum of our statistics. And we have many strengths, we're resilient, we've survived, and we've thrived to this point. And we have vibrant stories of hope and triumph. But what we're very aware of is that Black women within this country are more likely to die early, prematurely, less than 65 years of age, than women of other racial and ethnic backgrounds. We're more likely to suffer from chronic disease, such as diabetes and obesity and hypertension. And among women, we have the highest death rates from breast cancer and other forms of cancer. And if we look at reproductive justice angle and our reproductive health, we're less likely to really feel powerful in our choices that we can really make for our bodies as it relates whether to having babies or not, or even being able to just raise our babies in safe and healthy environments. And we know that our babies are actually 2 to 3 times more likely to die before reaching the first year of age.
2 to 3 times more likely to die before reaching the first year of age. Let's talk about why. How much of this can be attributed to access to care versus bias at the doctor's office and medical schools and in other areas?
Access to health care is absolutely important. Access that's timely, respectful, of great quality is absolutely essential. And yes, there is plenty of evidence that indicates that healthcare professionals exhibit the same levels of what we call implicit bias or unconscious bias as the wider population. And so this is noticed even as young as medical students. And it really shouldn't be a surprise because many students and all of us are very normalized to the whiteness of our society. And so while race is a social construct of which there is absolutely no biological basis, we know that, as I said, many students have these similar false beliefs about the biological differences of people by race. And we're hearing things such as, you know, Black people don't feel pain as much as whites. We have stats that show that Black people aren't given pain medicine in the same way that whites have been given pain medicine. You know, and that's what white supremacy and slavery really has done to the people, and it's translated across all of our systems, and it has consequences. It has consequences even within our healthcare system. And so no matter how well-intended you may be as a physician, those biases absolutely have impact on the care of a patient, but also has impact on exacerbating the health inequities that exist.
So, Dr. Maybank, in a recent NPR survey, 21% of Black women said they were so concerned about being discriminated against that they didn't seek medical attention at all. How does that impact their ultimate health outcome, being so afraid that if you see a doctor, he'll discriminate against you?
It creates a lot of mistrust, right? It creates mistrust in the way that women feel that they're able to engage with their physicians, and do they trust what they're telling them? Do they trust to follow up and to take certain medications or treatment regimens? All of this has tremendous impact, not only about the women themselves, and many women are caretakers of families, so it actually can impact families also.
I want to point you to, for a second, the American Cancer Society's recent recommendations about breast cancer screening. Many medical professionals say it doesn't actually serve women of color. How is that even possible?
Well, part of the challenge with that has to do with Black women actually, what we're finding, are getting cancer earlier. And they're also getting more aggressive types of cancer. They're calling it triple negative cancers. And so they're also dying earlier. And so it's really, is this recommendation that's been put out there from 40 to 45 years, is that really working for Black women? And the reasons behind why they're getting more aggressive cancers are not fully clear at this present time. But I think, again, it speaks to these broader issues around, you know, what impacts health. And if what's really striking about what I mentioned earlier about the maternal mortality is that Black women with a college degree or higher, because there are a lot of assumptions that if you have higher income or higher education, you totally escape, you know, the impacts of, you know, disparities and discrimination and racism. But if you're a Black woman with a college degree or higher, you actually still have higher rates of complication at pregnancy than a white woman, an Asian woman, or a Latina woman with less than a high school degree in New York City.
So as we're tying up, what would you say to women who are worried about facing discrimination at the doctor? How do you empower these women of color?
Well, there are several things that need to happen. I think, you know, as the institution, we have to take responsibility. And I think that is an important demand from women, that we need to own up and be accountable for the racism that we have perpetuated over the years. And it's fine to speak up and to advocate and to say if you're not being treated right or being treated fairly. It's absolutely essential for the institutions to go through processes that help them become an anti-racist, multicultural organization. And some institutions, such as ourselves at the New York City Department of Health, are really stepping up to that call and naming racism, because if you don't name it, you absolutely can't change it. And though what's really powerful at this point in time, we're in a time where many movements are happening. And Black women have been advocates and have led movements all across the years. We look at the anti-lynching movement, you know, of the early 1920s, led by Ida B. Wells to fight for the dignity of women. We look at now and we look at Black Lives Matter. We look at Me Too, the Women's March, all led by women of color. All of these will help and improve the health of Black women across this country.
Thank you very much, Dr. Aletha Maybank, Deputy Commissioner and Founding Director of the Center for Health Equity in New York City's Health Department. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Remember, you can find every segment of our series so far at thetakeaway.org/womenspain. What questions do you have about maternal and reproductive health in the U.S. today? And how could it be improved? We'll put some of your queries to an expert tomorrow on the program. Call and leave a message at 877-8-MY-TAKE. And thanks to the many of you who called us with your stories.
This is Shayna calling from the Bay Area. Absolutely, in my case, age and skin color were at the intersection of a doctor's bias. When I was in college and I had never engaged in sexual activity, I went to an on-campus doctor for some issues that happened with my reproductive system that included severe bleeding. The doctor informed me that my body had terminated a pregnancy naturally. I was super confused, and I once again launched into explaining to that doctor, hey, I'm not sexually active. Yeah, that's not the right explanation. He again explained to me about how my pregnancy had been self-aborted. I remember feeling belittled, offended, and being scared, just really worried that this condition that was obviously very serious was being left untreated to get worse. I know now that I cannot be silent when things like this happen.
Hi, this is Julie for the Bronx. Until I stepped in on my mother's care, she was being treated as if her pain was non-existent. And she was almost always given the least aggressive type of care until I stepped in with my research and spreadsheets and demanded the type of care that ultimately kept her alive for 4 more years. That's why we need to take control of our own health, because doctors definitely treat people of color differently.
My name is Susie Cullen. I live in Denver, New Jersey. A number of years ago, I went to the hospital with excruciating pain and was told by the triage nurse that I was just an addict, and I was made to wait 6 hours before I saw the doctors, who also thought I was an addict. In the end, I had sciatica, which necessitated surgery, so I'm very familiar with that issue.
And we have some big news to share with you today. Beginning in just over a month, The Takeaway will be hosted by Tanzina Vega. You may have heard Tanzina guest host the show this year. She's one of the most trusted voices in journalism, and The Takeaway is really thrilled to have her at the helm. Tanzina will get started here in May. Until then, Tanz Willick will be with you, and he's back next week from a well-deserved vacation. But Tanzina is here right now. ¿Cómo está, prima? Hey, what do you have to say?
I am great. Thank you so much. I'm so excited to be with The Takeaway, to join The Takeaway as your host and your guide through this news. I mean, we have so much to unpack these days, especially understanding the really confusing and complicated times and issues that we're living through and living in. And I can't wait to get started. So why don't we start out by telling our audience to tweet me at Tanzina Vega and tell me, who do you want me to interview? What types of stories are you expecting us to cover? What areas would you like us to dig deep into? And we'll start collecting those before I get started in May. And we really look forward to engaging with this audience. So thank you so much.
I'm thrilled that you're here, Tanzina. Thank you so much for listening. Until tomorrow, I'm Duarte Giraldino. This is The Takeaway. In India, President Trump has a decade's worth of business allies.
I am a big fan of Hindu, and I am a big fan of India. Big fan. Big fan.
But could his relationships and development projects cause trouble in the White House? That's next time on the Takeaway Podcast.